the love he inspires and transforms it into a real-life experience, the girl panics. Her idol becomes a male she shies away from, disgusted. There are flirtatious adolescents who do everything in their power to seduce a seemingly interesting or fascinating man, but paradoxically, they recoil if he manifests too vivid an emotion in return. He was attractive because he seemed inaccessible. In love, he becomes commonplace. He's just a man like the others. The young woman blames him for her disgrace. She uses this pretext to refuse physical contacts that shock her virgin sensibilities. If the girl gives in to her ideal one, she remains unmoved in his arms, and it happens, says Stekel, that obsessed girls commit suicide after such scenes, where the whole construction of amorous imagination collapses because the ideal one is seen in the form of a brutal animal. Note, frigidity in woman. The taste for the impossible often leads the girl to fall in love with the man when he begins to court one of her friends, and very often she chooses a married man. She is readily fascinated by a Don Juan. She dreams of submitting and attaching herself to this seducer that no woman has ever held on to, and she kindles the hope of reforming him. But in fact, she knows she will fail in her undertaking, and this is the reason for her choice. Some girls end up forever incapable of knowing real and complete love. They will search all their lives for an ideal impossible to reach. But there is a conflict between the girl's narcissism and the experiences for which her sexuality destines her. The woman only accepts herself as the inessential on the condition of finding herself the essential once again by abdicating. In making herself object, suddenly, she has become an idol in which she proudly recognizes herself, but she refuses the implacable dialectic that makes her return to the inessential. She wants to be a fascinating treasure, not a thing to be taken. She loves to seem like a marvelous fetish, charged with magic emanations, not to see herself as flesh that lets herself be seen, touched, bruised. Thus, man prizes the woman prey, but flees the ogress Demeter. Proud to capture masculine interest and to arouse admiration, woman is revolted by being captured in return. With puberty, she learns shame, and shame is mixed with her coquetry and vanity. Men's gazes flatter and hurt her at the same time. She would only like to be seen to the extent that she shows herself. Eyes are always too penetrating. Hence, the inconsistency disconcerting to men. She displays her décolletage and her legs, but she blushes and becomes vexed when someone looks at her. She enjoys provoking the male, but if she sees she has aroused his desire, she backs off in disgust. Masculine desire is an offense as much as a tribute, insofar as she feels responsible for her charm, as she feels she is using it freely. She is enchanted with her victories. But while her features, her forms, her flesh are given and endured, she wants to keep them from this foreign and indiscreet freedom that covets them. Here is the deep meaning of this primal modesty, which interferes in a disconcerting way with the boldest coquetry. A little girl can be surprisingly audacious because she does not realize that her initiatives reveal her in her passivity. As soon as she sees this, she becomes indignant and angry. Nothing is more ambiguous than a look. It exists at a distance, and that distance makes it seem respectable, but insidiously, it takes hold of the perceived image. The unripe woman struggles with these traps. She begins to let herself go, but just as quickly, she tenses up and kills the desire in herself. In her as yet uncertain body, the caress is felt at times as an unpleasant tickling, at times as a delicate pleasure. A kiss moves her first and then abruptly makes her laugh. She follows each surrender with a revolt. She lets herself be kissed, but then she wipes her mouth noticeably. She is smiling and caring, then suddenly ironic and hostile. She makes promises and deliberately forgets them. In such a way, Mathilde de la Mole is seduced by Julianne's beauty and rare qualities, desirous to reach an exceptional destiny through her love, but fiercely refusing the domination of her own senses and that of a foreign consciousness, she goes from servility to arrogance, from supplication to scorn. She demands an immediate payback for everything she gives. Such is also Monique, whose profile is drawn by Marcel Arlan, who confuses excitement with sin, for whom love is a shameful abdication, whose blood is hot, but who detests this ardor and who, while bridling, submits to it. The unripe fruit defends herself against man by exhibiting a childish and perverse nature. This is often how the girl has been described, half wild, half dutiful. Colette, for one, depicted her in Claudine at School and also in Le Blé en Herbe, Green Wheat, in the guise of the seductive Vanka. She maintains an interest in the world around her, over which she reigns sovereign, but she is also curious and feels a sensual and romantic desire for man. Vanka gets scratched by brambles, fishes for shrimp, and climbs trees, and yet she quivers when her friend Phil touches her hand. She knows the agitation of the body becoming flesh, the first revelation of woman as woman. Aroused, she begins to want to be pretty. At times, she does her hair. She uses makeup, dresses in gauzy organdy. She takes pleasure in appearing attractive and seductive. She also wants to exist for herself and not only for others. At other times, she throws on old formless dresses, unbecoming trousers. There is a whole part of her that criticizes seduction and considers it as giving in, so she purposely lets herself be seen with ink-stained fingers, messy hair, dirty. This rebelliousness gives her a clumsiness she resents. She is annoyed by it, blushes, becomes even more awkward, and is horrified by these aborted attempts at seduction. At this point, the girl no longer wants to be a child, but she does not accept becoming an adult, and she blames herself for her childishness and then for her female resignation. She is in a state of constant denial. This is the characteristic trait of the girl and gives the key to most of her behavior. She does not accept the destiny nature and society assigned to her, and yet she does not actively repudiate it. She is too divided internally to enter into combat with the world. She confines herself to escaping reality or to contesting it symbolically. Each of her desires is matched by an anxiety. She is eager to take possession of her future, but she fears breaking with her past. She would like to have a man. She balks at being his prey. And behind each fear hides a desire. Rape is abhorrent to her, but she aspires to passivity. Thus she is doomed to bad faith and all its ruses. She is predisposed to all sorts of negative obsessions that express the ambivalence of desire and anxiety. One of the most common forms of adolescent contestation is giggling. High school girls and shop girls burst into laughter while recounting love or risque stories, while talking about their flirtations, meeting men, or seeing lovers kiss. I have known schoolgirls going to Lover's Lane in the Luxembourg Gardens just to laugh, and others going to the Turkish baths to make fun of the fat women with sagging stomachs and hanging breasts they saw there. Scoffing at the female body, ridiculing men, laughing at love, are ways of disavowing sexuality. This laughter that defies adults is a way of overcoming one's own embarrassment. One plays with images and words to kill the dangerous magic of them. For example, I saw 12-year-old students burst out laughing when they saw a Latin text with the word femur. If in addition the girl lets herself be kissed and petted, she will get her revenge in laughing outright at her partner or with friends. I remember in a train compartment one night, two girls being fondled one after the other by a traveling salesman, overjoyed with his good luck. Between each session, they laughed hysterically, reverting to the behavior of the awkward age in a mixture of sexuality and shame. Girls giggle, and they also resort to language to help them. Some use words whose coarseness would make their brothers blush. Half ignorant, they are even less shocked by those expressions that do not evoke very precise images. The aim, of course, is to prevent these images from taking shape, at least to diffuse them. The dirty stories high school girls tell each other are less to satisfy sexual instincts than to deny sexuality. They only want to consider the humorous side, like a mechanical or almost surgical operation. But like laughter, the use of obscene language is not only a protest, it is also a defiance of adults, a sort of sacrilege, a deliberately perverse kind of behavior. Rebuffing nature and society, the girl nettles and challenges them by many oddities. She often has food manias. She eats pencil lead, sealing wax, bits of wood, live shrimp. She swallows dozens of aspirins at a time, or she even ingests flies or spiders. I knew a girl, very obedient otherwise, who made horrible mixtures of coffee and white wine that she forced herself to swallow. Other times, she ate sugar soaked in vinegar. I saw another chewing determinedly into a white worm found in lettuce. All children endeavor to experience the world with their eyes, their hands, and more intimately, their mouths and stomachs. But at the awkward age, the girl takes particular pleasure in exploring what is indigestible and repugnant. Very often, she is attracted by what is disgusting. One of them, quite pretty and attractive when she wanted to be, and carefully dressed, proved really fascinated by everything that seemed dirty to her. She touched insects, looked at dirty sanitary napkins, sucked the blood of her cuts. Playing with dirty things is obviously a way of overcoming disgust. This feeling becomes much more important at puberty. The girl is disgusted by her too carnal body, by menstrual blood, by adults' sexual practices, by the male she is destined for. She denies it by indulging herself specifically in the familiarity of everything that disgusts her. Since I have to bleed each month, I prove that my blood does not scare me by drinking that of my cuts. Since I will have to submit myself to a revolting test, why not eat a white worm? This attitude is affirmed more clearly in self-mutilation, so frequent at this age. The girl gashes her thigh with a razor, burns herself with cigarettes, cuts and scratches herself. So as not to go to a boring garden party, a girl during my youth cut her foot with an axe and had to spend 6 weeks in bed. These sadomasochistic practices are both an anticipation of the sexual experience and a revolt against it. Girls have to undergo these tests, hardening themselves to all possible ordeals and rendering them harmless, including the wedding night. When she puts a slug on her chest, when she swallows a bottle of aspirin, when she wounds herself, the girl is defying her future lover. You will never inflict on me anything more horrible than I inflict on myself. These are morose and haughty initiations in sexual adventure. Destined to be a passive prey, she claims her freedom right up to submitting to pain and disgust. When she inflicts the cut of the knife, the burning of a coal on herself, she is protesting against the penetration that deflowers her. She protests by nullifying it. Masochistic, since she welcomes the pain caused by her behavior, she is above all sadistic. As autonomous subject, she beats, scorns, and tortures this dependent flesh, this flesh condemned to submission that she detests, but from which she does not want to separate herself. Because in all these situations, she does not choose authentically to reject her destiny. Sadomasochistic crazes imply a fundamental bad faith. If the girl indulges in them, it means she accepts, through her rejections, her future as woman. She would not mutilate her flesh with hatred if first she did not recognize herself as flesh. Even her violent outbursts arise from a situation of resignation. When a boy revolts against his father or against the world, he engages in effective violence. He picks a quarrel with a friend. He fights. He affirms himself as subject with his fists. He imposes himself on the world. He goes beyond it. But affirming herself, imposing herself, are forbidden to the adolescent girl, and that is what fills her heart with revolt. She hopes neither to change the world nor to emerge from it. She knows, or at least believes, and perhaps even wishes, herself tied up. She can only destroy. There is despair in her rage. During a frustrating evening, she breaks glasses, windows, vases. It is not to overcome her lot. It is only a symbolic protest. The girl rebels against her future enslavement through her present powerlessness, and her vain outbursts, far from freeing her from her bonds, often merely restrict her even more. Violence against herself or the universe around her always has a negative character. It is more spectacular than effective. The boy who climbs rocks or fights with his friends regards physical pain, the injuries and the bumps, as an insignificant consequence of the positive activities he indulges in. He neither seeks nor flees them for themselves, except if an inferiority complex puts him in a situation similar to women's. The girl watches herself suffer. She seeks in her own heart the taste of violence and revolt rather than being concerned with their results. Her perversity stems from the fact that she remains stuck in the childish universe from which she cannot or does not really want to escape. She struggles in her cage rather than seeking to get out of it. Her attitudes are negative, reflexive, and symbolic. This perversity can take disturbing forms. Many young virgins are kleptomaniacs. Kleptomania is a very ambiguous sexual sublimation. The desire to transgress laws, to violate a taboo, the giddiness of the dangerous and forbidden act are certainly essential in the girl thief. But there is a double face. Taking objects without having the right is affirming one's autonomy arrogantly. It is putting oneself forward as subject facing the thing stolen and the society that condemns stealing, and it is rejecting the established order as well as defying its guardians. But this defiance also has a masochistic side. The thief is fascinated by the risks she runs, by the abyss she will be thrown into if she is caught. It is the danger of being caught that gives such a voluptuous attraction to the act of taking. Thus, looked at with blame, or with a hand placed on her shoulder in shame, she can realize herself as object, totally and without recourse. Taking without being taken, and the anguish of becoming prey, is the dangerous game of adolescent feminine sexuality. All perverse or illegal conduct found in girls has the same meaning. Some specialize in sending anonymous letters. Others find pleasure in mystifying those around them. One 14-year-old persuaded a whole village that a house was haunted by spirits. They simultaneously enjoy the clandestine exercise of their power, disobedience, defiance of society, and the risk of being exposed. This is such an important element of their pleasure that they often unmask themselves, and they even sometimes accuse themselves of faults or crimes they have not committed. It is not surprising that the refusal to become object leads to constituting oneself as object. This process is common to all negative obsessions. It is in a single movement that in a hysterical paralysis, the ill person fears paralysis, desires it, and brings it on. He is cured from it only by no longer thinking about it. Likewise with psychasthenic tics. The depth of the girl's bad faith is what links her to these types of neuroses, manias, tics, conspiracies, perversities. Many neurotic symptoms are found in her due to this ambivalence of desire and anxiety that has been pointed out. It is quite common, for example, for her to run away. She goes away at random. She wanders far from her father's house, and 2 or 3 days later, she comes back by herself. It is not a real departure or a real act of rupture with the family. It is mere play acting. And the girl is often totally disconcerted if it is suggested that she leave her circle definitively. She wants to leave while not wanting to at the same time. Running away is sometimes linked to fantasies of prostitution. The girl dreams she is a prostitute. She plays this role more or less timidly. She wears excessive makeup. She leans out the window and winks at passersby. In some cases, she leaves the house and carries the drama so far that it becomes confused with reality. Such conduct often expresses a disgust with sexual desire, a feeling of guilt. Since I have these thoughts, these appetites, I am no better than a prostitute. I am one, thinks a girl. Sometimes she attempts to free herself. Let's get it over with. Let's go to the limit, she says to herself. She wants to prove to herself that sexuality is of little importance by giving herself to the first one. At the same time, such an attitude is often a manifestation of hostility to the mother, either that the girl is horrified by her austere virtue, or that she suspects her mother of being herself of easy morality, or she holds a grudge against her father who has shown himself too indifferent. In any case, in this obsession, as in the fantasies of pregnancy about which we have already spoken and that are often associated with it, there is the meeting of this inextricable confusion of revolt and complicity, characterized by psychasthenic dizziness. It is noteworthy that in all these behaviors, the girl does not seek to go beyond the natural and social order. She does not attempt to push back the limits of the possible or to effectuate a transmutation of values. She settles for manifesting her revolt within an established world where boundaries and laws are preserved. This is the often defined devilish attitude, implying a basic deception. The good is recognized so that it can be trampled upon. The rule is set so that it can be violated. The sacred is respected so that it is possible to perpetuate the sacrileges. The girl's attitude is defined essentially by the fact that in the agonizing shadows of bad faith, she refuses the world and her own destiny at the same time as she accepts them. However, she does not confine herself to contesting negatively the situation imposed on her. She also tries to compensate for its insufficiencies. Although the future frightens her, the present dissatisfies her. She hesitates to become woman. She frets at still being only a child. She has already left her past. She is not yet committed to a new life. She is occupied, but she does not do anything. Because she does not do anything, she has nothing. She is nothing. She tries to fill this void by play-acting and mystifications. She is criticized for being devious, a liar, and troublesome. The truth is, she is doomed to secrets and lies. At 16, a woman has already gone through disturbing experiences: puberty, menstrual periods, awakening of sexuality, first arousals, first passions, fears, disgust, and ambiguous experiences. She has hidden all these things in her heart. She has learned to guard her secrets preciously. The mere fact of having to hide her sanitary napkins and of concealing her periods inclines her to lies. In the short story, Old Mortality, Catherine Ann Porter recounts that young American women from the South, around 1900, made themselves ill by swallowing mixtures of salt and lemon to stop their periods when going to balls. They were afraid that the young men would recognize their state by the bags under their eyes, by contact with their hands, by a smell perhaps, and this idea upset them. It is difficult to play the idol, the fairy, or the remote princess when one feels a bloody piece of material between one's legs and, more generally, when one knows the primal misery of being a body. Modesty, a spontaneous refusal to let oneself be grasped as flesh, comes close to hypocrisy. But above all, the adolescent girl is condemned to the lie of pretending to be object and a prestigious one, while she experiences herself as an uncertain, dispersed existence, knowing her failings. Makeup, false curls, corsets, padded bras are lies. The face itself becomes a mask. Spontaneous expressions are produced artfully. A wondrous passivity is imitated. There is nothing more surprising than suddenly discovering in the exercise of one's feminine functions a physiognomy with which one is familiar. Its transcendence denies itself and imitates immanence. One's eyes no longer perceive, they reflect. One's body no longer lives, it waits. Every gesture and smile becomes an appeal. Disarmed, available, the girl is nothing but a flower offered, a fruit to be picked. Man encourages her in these lures by demanding to be lured. Then he gets irritated. He accuses. But for the guileless girl, he has nothing but indifference and even hostility. He is only seduced by the one who sets traps for him. Offered, she is still the one who stalks her prey. Her passivity takes the form of an undertaking. She makes her weakness a tool of her strength. Since she is forbidden to attack outright, she is reduced to maneuvers and calculations. And it is in her interest to appear freely given. Therefore, she will be criticized for being perfidious and treacherous, and she is. But it is true that she is obliged to offer man the myth of her submission because he insists on dominating. And can one demand that she stifle her most essential claims? Her complacence can only be perverted right from the outset. Besides, she cheats not only out of concerted, deliberate ruse, because all roads are barred to her, because she cannot do, because she must be. A curse weighs on her. As a child, she played at being a dancer or a saint. Later, she plays at being herself. What is really the truth? In the area in which she has been shut up, this is a word without sense. Truth is reality unveiled, and unveiling occurs through acts, but she does not act. The romances she tells herself about herself, and that she also often tells others, seem better ways of expressing the possibilities she feels in herself than the plain account of her daily life. She is unable to take stock of herself, so she consoles herself by play-acting. She embodies a character she seeks to give importance to. She tries to stand out by extravagant behavior because she does not have the right to distinguish herself in specific activities. She knows she is without responsibilities, insignificant in this world of men. She makes trouble because she has nothing else important to do. Girardeau's Electra is a woman who makes trouble, because it is up to Orestes alone to accomplish a real murder with a real sword. Like the child, the girl wears herself out in scenes and rages. She makes herself ill. She manifests signs of hysteria to try to attract attention and be someone who counts. She interferes in the destiny of others so that she can count. She uses any weapon she can. She tells secrets. She invents others. She betrays. She calumniates. She needs tragedy around her to feel alive, since she finds no support in her own life. She is unpredictable for the same reason. The fantasies we form and the images by which we are lulled are contradictory. Only action unifies the diversity of time. The girl does not have a real will, but has desires, and she jumps from one to the other at random. What makes her flightiness sometimes dangerous is that at every moment, committing herself in dream only, she commits herself wholly. She puts herself on a level of intransigence and perfection. She has a taste for the definitive and absolute. If she cannot control the future, she wants to attain the eternal. I will never give up. I want everything always. I need to prefer my life in order to accept it, writes Marie Lenéru. So echoes Ennui's Antigone. I want everything immediately. This childish imperialism can only be found in an individual who dreams his destiny. Dreams abolish time and obstacles. They need to be exaggerated to compensate for the small amount of reality. Whoever has authentic projects knows a finitude that is the gauge of one's concrete power. The girl wants to receive everything because there is nothing that depends on her. That is where her character of enfant terrible comes from, faced with adults and man in particular. She does not accept the limitations an individual's insertion in the real world imposes. She defies him to go beyond them. Thus, Hilda expects Sulness to give her a kingdom, as she is not the one who has to conquer it. She wants it without limits. She demands that he build the highest tower ever built and that he climb as high as he builds. He hesitates to climb because he is afraid of heights. She who remains on the ground and looks on denies contingency and human weakness. She does not accept that reality imposes a limit on her dreams of grandeur. Note, refer to Ibsen, the Master Builder. Adults always seem mean and cautious to the girl who stops at nothing because she has nothing to lose. Imagining herself taking the boldest risks, she dares them to match her in reality. Unable to put herself to the test, she invests herself with the most astonishing qualities without fear of being contradicted. However, her uncertainty also stems from this lack of control. She dreams she is infinite. She is nevertheless alienated in the character she offers for the admiration of others. It depends on these foreign consciousnesses. This double she identifies with herself, but to whose presence she passively submits, is dangerous for her. This explains why she is touchy and vain. The slightest criticism or jibe destabilizes her. Her worth does not derive from her own effort, but from a fickle approbation. This is not defined by individual activities, but by general reputation. It seems to be quantitatively measurable. The price of merchandise decreases when it becomes too common. Thus, the girl is only rare, exceptional, remarkable, or extraordinary, if no other one is. Her female companions are rivals or enemies. She tries to denigrate, to deny them. She is jealous and hostile. It is clear that all the faults for which the adolescent girl is reproached merely express her situation. It is a painful condition to know one is passive and dependent at the age of hope and ambition, at the age when the will to live and to take a place in the world intensifies. Woman learns at this conquering age that no conquest is allowed her, that she must disavow herself, that her future depends on men's good offices. New social and sexual aspirations are awakened, but they are condemned to remain unsatisfied. All her vital or spiritual impulses are immediately barred. It is understandable that she should have trouble establishing her balance. Her erratic mood, her tears, and her nervous crises are less the result of a physiological fragility than the sign of her deep maladjustment. However, this situation that the girl flees by a thousand inauthentic paths is also one that she sometimes assumes authentically. Her shortcomings make her irritating, but her unique virtues sometimes make her astonishing. Both have the same origin. From her rejection of the world, from her unsettled waiting, and from her nothingness, she can create a springboard for herself and emerge then in her solitude and her freedom. The girl is secretive, tormented, in the throes of difficult conflicts. This complexity enriches her. Her interior life develops more deeply than her brother's. She is more attentive to her heart's desires that thus become more subtle, more varied. She has more psychological sense than boys turned toward external goals. She is able to give weight to these revolts that oppose her to the world. She avoids the traps of seriousness and conformism. The concerted lies of her circle meet with her irony and clear-sightedness. She tests her situation's ambiguity on a daily basis. Beyond sterile protest, she can have the courage to throw into question established optimism, preconceived values, and hypocritical and reassuring morality. Such is Maggie, the moving example given in The Mill on the Floss, in which George Eliot embodied the doubts and courageous rebellions of her youth against Victorian England. The heroes, particularly Tom, Maggie's brother, stubbornly affirm conventional wisdom, immobilizing morality in formal rules. Maggie tries to reintroduce a breath of life. She overturns them. She goes to the limits of her solitude and emerges as a pure freedom beyond the fossilized male universe. The adolescent girl barely finds anything but a negative use of this freedom. But her openness can engender a precious faculty of receptivity. She will prove to be devoted, attentive, understanding, and loving. Rosamund Lehman's heroines are marked by this docile generosity. In Invitation to the Waltz, Olivia, still shy and gauche, and barely interested in her appearance, is seen scrutinizing this world she will enter tomorrow with excited curiosity. She listens with all her heart to her succession of dancers. She endeavors to answer them according to their wishes. She is their echo. She vibrates. She accepts everything that is offered. Judy, the heroine of Dusty Answer, has the same endearing quality. She has not relinquished childhood joys. She likes to bathe naked at night in the Park River. She loves nature, books, beauty, and life. She does not cultivate a narcissistic cult. Without lies, without egotism, she does not look for an exaltation of self through men. Her love is a gift. She bestows it on any being who seduces her, man or woman, Jennifer or Roddy. She gives herself without losing herself. She leads an independent student life. She has her own world, her own projects. But what distinguishes her from a boy is her attitude of expectation, her tender docility. In a subtle way, she is, in spite of everything, destined to the other. The other has a marvelous dimension in her eyes to the point that she is in love with all the young men of the neighboring family, their house, their sister, and their universe, all at the same time. It is not as a friend, it is as other that Jennifer fascinates her. And she charms Roddy and his cousins by her capacity to yield to them, to shape herself to their desires. She is patience, sweetness, acceptance, and silent suffering. Different but also captivating in the way she welcomes into her heart those she cherishes, Tessa, in Margaret Kennedy's The Constant Nymph, is simultaneously spontaneous, wild, and giving. She refuses to abdicate anything of herself. Finery, makeup, disguises, hypocrisy, acquired charms, caution, and female submission are repugnant to her. She desires to be loved, but not behind a mask. She yields to Lewis's moods, but without servility. She understands him. She vibrates in unison with him. But if they ever argue, Lewis knows that caresses will not subdue her. While authoritarian and vain Florence lets herself be conquered by kisses, Tessa succeeds in the extraordinary accomplishment of remaining free in her love, allowing her to love without either hostility or pride. Her nature has all the lures of artifice. To please, she never degrades herself, never lowers herself or locks herself in as object. Surrounded by artists who have committed their whole existence to musical creation, she does not feel this devouring demon within her. She wholly endeavors to love, understand, and help them. She does it effortlessly, out of a tender and spontaneous generosity, which is why she remains perfectly autonomous, even in the instances in which she forgets herself in favor of others. Thanks to this pure authenticity, she is spared the conflicts of adolescence. She can suffer from the world's harshness. She is not divided within herself. She is harmonious both as a carefree child and as a very wise woman. The sensitive and generous girl, receptive and ardent, is very ready to become a great lover. When not encountering love, she may encounter poetry. Because she does not act, she watches, she feels, she records. She responds deeply to a color or a smile. Because her destiny is scattered outside her, in cities already built, on mature men's faces, she touches and tastes both passionately and more gratuitously than the young man. As she is poorly integrated into the human universe and has trouble adapting to it, she is, like the child, able to see it. Instead of being interested only in her grasp of things, she focuses on their meaning. She perceives particular profiles, unexpected metamorphoses. She rarely feels a creative urge, and all too often she lacks the techniques that would allow her to express herself. But in conversations, letters, literary essays, and rough drafts, she does show an original sensibility. The girl throws herself passionately into things because she is not yet mutilated in her transcendence. And the fact that she does not accomplish anything, that she is nothing, will make her drive even more fervent. Empty and unlimited, what she will seek to reach from within her nothingness is all. That is why she will devote a special love to nature. More than the adolescent boy, she worships it. Untamed and inhuman, nature encompasses most obviously the totality of what is. The adolescent girl has not yet annexed any part of the universe. Thanks to this impoverishment, the whole universe is her kingdom. When she takes possession of it, she also proudly takes possession of herself. Colette often recounted these youthful orgies. For even then I so loved the dawn that my mother granted it to me as a reward. She used to agree to wake me at 3:30, and off I would go, an empty basket on each arm, towards the kitchen gardens that sheltered in the narrow bend of the river, in search of strawberries, black currants, and hairy gooseberries. At 3:30, everything slumbered still in a primal blue, blurred and dewy. And as I went down the sandy road, the mist, grounded by its own weight, bathed first my legs, then my well-built little body, reaching at last to my mouth and ears, and finally to that most sensitive part of all, my nostrils. It was on that road and at that hour that I first became aware of my own self, experienced an inexpressible state of grace, and felt one with the first breath of air that stirred, the first bird, and the sun so newly born that it still looked not quite round. I came back when the bell rang for the first mass, but not before I had eaten my fill, not before I had described a great circle in the woods. Like a dog out hunting on its own, I tasted the water of the two hidden springs which I worshipped. Note, Sido. Mary Webb describes, in The House in Dormer Forest, the intense joys a girl can know in communion with a familiar landscape. When the atmosphere of the house became too thunderous and Amber's nerves were strained to breaking point, she crept away to the upper woods. It seemed to her that while Dormer lived by law, the forest lived by impulse. Through a gradual awakening to natural beauty, she reached a perception of beauty peculiar to herself. She began to perceive analogies. Nature became for her not a fortuitous assemblage of pretty things, but a harmony, a poem solemn and austere. Beauty breathed there, light shone there that was not of the flower or the star. A tremor, mysterious and thrilling, seemed to run with the light through the whispering forest. So her going out into the green world had in it something of a religious rite. On a still morning, she went up to the bird's orchard. She often did this before the day of petty irritation began. She found some comfort in the inconsequence of the bird people. She came at last to the upper wood and was instantly at grips with beauty. There was for her literally something of wrestling, of the mood which says, I will not let thee go until thou bless me. Leaning against a wild pear tree, she was aware, by her inward hearing, of the tidal wave of sap that rose so full and strong that she could almost imagine it roaring like the sea. Then a tremor of wind shook the flowering treetops, and she awoke again to the senses, to the strangeness of these utterances of the leaves. Every petal, every leaf, seemed to be conning some memory of profundities whence it had come. Every curving flower seemed full of echoes too majestic for its fragility. A breath of scented air came from the hilltops and stole among the branches. That which had form and knew the mortality which is in form trembled before that which passed, formless and immortal. Because of it, the place became no mere congregation of trees, but a thing fierce as stellar space, for it possesses itself forever in a vitality withheld, immutable. It was this that drew Amber with breathless curiosity into the secret haunts of nature. It was this that struck her now into a kind of ecstasy. Women as different as Emily Bronte and Anna de Noailles experienced similar fervor in their youth, and it continued throughout their lives. The texts I have cited convincingly show the comfort the adolescent girl finds in fields and woods. In the paternal house reign mother, laws, custom, and routine, and she wants to wrest herself from this past. She wants to become a sovereign subject in her own turn. But socially, she only accedes to her adult life by becoming woman. She pays for her liberation with an abdication. But in the midst of plants and animals, she is a human being, a subject, a freedom. She is freed both from her family and from males. She finds an image of the solitude of her soul in the secrecy of forests, and the tangible figure of transcendence in the vast horizons of the plains. She is herself this limitless land, this summit jutting toward the sky. She can follow, she will follow, these roads that leave for an unknown future. Sitting on the hilltop, she dominates the riches of the world spread out at her feet, given to her. Through the water's palpitations, the shimmering of the light, she anticipates the joys, tears, and ecstasies that she does not yet know. The adventures of her own heart are confusedly promised her by ripples on the pond and patches of sun. Smells and colors speak a mysterious language, but one word stands out with triumphant clarity. Life. Existence is not only an abstract destiny inscribed in town hall registers. It is future and carnal richness. Having a body no longer seems like a shameful failing. In these desires that the adolescent girl repudiates under the maternal gaze, she recognizes the sap mounting in the trees. She is no longer cursed. She proudly claims her kinship with leaves and flowers. She rumples a corolla, and she knows that a living prey will fill her empty hands one day. Flesh is no longer filth. It is joy and beauty. Merged with sky and heath, the girl is this vague breath that stirs up and kindles the universe, and she is every sprig of heather, an individual rooted in the soil and infinite consciousness. She is both spirit and life. Her presence is imperious and triumphant like that of the earth itself. Beyond nature, she sometimes seeks an even more remote and stunning reality. She is willing to lose herself in mystical ecstasies. In periods of faith, many young female souls demanded that God fill the emptiness of their being. The vocations of Catherine of Siena and Teresa of Avila were revealed to them at a young age. Note, we will return to the specific characteristics of the feminine mystic. Joan of Arc was a girl. In other periods, humanity appears the supreme end, so the mystical impulse flows into defined projects. But it is also a youthful desire for the absolute that gave birth to the flame that nourished the life of Madame Roland or Rosa Luxemburg. From her subjugation, her impoverishment, and the depths of her refusal, the girl can extract the most daring courage. She finds poetry, she finds heroism too. One of the ways of assuming the fact that she is poorly integrated into society is to go beyond its restricting horizons. The richness and strength of their nature and fortunate circumstances have enabled some women to continue in their adult lives their passionate projects from adolescence. But these are exceptions. George Eliot had Maggie Tulliver, and Margaret Kennedy had Tessa die for good reason. It was a bitter destiny that the Bronte sisters had. The girl is touching because she rises up against the world, weak and alone. But the world is too powerful. She persists in refusing it. She is broken. Belle de Zoylen, who overwhelmed all of Europe with her mind's originality and caustic power, frightened all her suitors. Her refusal to make concessions condemned her to long years of celibacy that weighed on her since she declared that the expression virgin and martyr was a pleonasm. This stubbornness is rare. In the immense majority of cases, the girl is aware that the fight is much too unequal, and she ends up yielding. "You will all die at 15," writes Diderot to Sophie Volant. When the fight has only been, as happens most often, a symbolic revolt, defeat is certain. Demanding in dreams, full of hope but passive, the girl makes adults smile with pity. They doom her to resignation. And in fact, The rebellious and eccentric girl that we left is found 2 years later, calmer, ready to consent to her woman's life. This is the future Colette predicted for Vanka. This is how the heroines of Mauriac's early novels appear. The adolescent crisis is a type of work similar to what Dr. Lagash calls the work of mourning. The girl buries her childhood slowly, this autonomous and imperious individual she has been, and she enters adult existence submissively. Of course, it is not possible to establish defined categories based on age alone. Some women remain infantile their whole lives. The behaviors we have described are sometimes perpetuated to an advanced age. Nevertheless, on the whole, there is a big difference between the girlish 15-year-old and an older girl. The latter is adapted to reality. She scarcely advances on the imaginary level. She is less divided within herself than before. At about 18, Marie Bashkirtseff writes, "The more I advance in age towards the end of my youth, the more I am covered with indifference. Little agitates me, and everything used to agitate me." Irene Rewelio T. comments, "To be accepted by men, you have to think and act like them. If you don't, they treat you like a black sheep, and solitude becomes your lot. And I, now, I'm fed up with solitude, and I want people not only around me, but with me. Living now and no longer existing and waiting and dreaming and telling yourself everything within yourself, your mouth shut and your body motionless." And further along, "With so much flattery, wooing and such, I become terribly ambitious. This is no longer the trembling, marvelous happiness of the 15-year-old. It is a kind of cold and hard intoxication to take my revenge on life, to climb. I flirt. I play at loving. I do not love. I gain in intelligence, in sang-froid, in ordinary lucidity. I lose my heart. It was as if it cracked. In 2 months, I left childhood behind." Approximately the same sound comes from these secrets of a 19-year-old girl. "In the old days, oh, what a conflict against a mentality that seemed incompatible with this century and the appeals of this century itself. I now have a peaceful feeling. Each new big idea that enters me, instead of provoking a painful upheaval, a destruction, and an incessant reconstruction, adapts marvelously to what is already in me. Now I go seamlessly from theoretical thinking to daily life without attempting continuity." Note, cited by DeBess in Adolescent Identity Crisis. The girl, unless she is particularly graceless, accepts her femininity in the end, and she is often happy to enjoy gratuitously the pleasures and triumphs she gets from settling definitively into her destiny. As she is not yet bound to any duty, irresponsible, available, for her, the present seems neither empty nor disappointing, since it is just one step. Dressing and flirting still have the lightness of a game, and her dreams of the future disguise their futility. This is how Virginia Woolf describes the impressions of a young coquette during a party. "I feel myself shining in the dark. Silk is on my knee. My silk legs rub smoothly together. The stones of a necklace lie cold on my throat. I am arrayed. I am prepared. My hair is swept in one curve. My lips are precisely red. I am ready now to join men and women on the stairs, my peers. I pass them, exposed to their gaze, as they are to mine. I now begin to unfurl in this scent, in this radiance, as a fern when its curled leaves unfurl. I feel 1,000 capacities spring up in me. I am arch, gay, languid, melancholy by turns. I am rooted, but I flow. All gold flowing that way, I say to this one, 'Come.' He approaches. He makes towards me. This is the most exciting moment I have ever known. I flutter. I ripple. Are we not lovely sitting together here? I in my satin, he in black and white. My peers may look at me now. I look straight back at you, men and women. I am one of you. This is my world. The door opens. The door goes on opening. Now, I think, Next time it opens, the whole of my life will be changed. The door opens. Come, I say to this one, rippling gold from head to heels. Come, and he comes towards me. Note, the waves. But the more the girl matures, the more maternal authority weighs on her. If she leads a housekeeper's life at home, she suffers from being only an assistant. She would like to devote her work to her own home, to her own children. Often the rivalry with her mother worsens. In particular, the older daughter is irritated if younger brothers and sisters are born. She feels her mother has done her time, and it is up to her now to bear children, to reign. If she works outside the house, she suffers when she returns home from still being treated as a simple member of the family and not as an autonomous individual. Less romantic than before, she begins to think much more of marriage than love. She no longer embellishes her future spouse with a prestigious halo. What she wishes for is to have a stable position in this world and to begin to lead her life as a woman. This is how Virginia Woolf describes the imaginings of a rich country girl. For soon in the hot midday, when the bees hum round the hollyhocks, my lover will come. He will stand under the cedar tree. To his one word I shall answer my one word. What has formed in me I shall give him. I shall have children. I shall have maids in aprons, men with pitchforks, a kitchen where they bring the ailing lambs to warm in baskets, where the hams hang and the onions glisten. I shall be like my mother, silent in a blue apron, locking up the cupboards. A similar dream dwells in poor Prusarn. It seemed such a terrible thing never to marry. All girls got married. And when girls got married, they had a cottage and a lamp, maybe, to light when their man came home. Or if it was only candles, it was all one, for they could put them in the window, and he'd think, there's my missus now, lit the candles. And then one day, Mrs. Begildy would be making a cot of rushes for him, and one day there'd be a babe in it, grand and solemn, and bidding letters sent round for the christening, and the neighbors coming round the babe's mother like bees round the queen. Often when things went wrong, I'd say to myself, ne'er mind, Prusarn. There'll come a day when you'll be queen in your own skep. Note, Mary Webb, Precious Bane. For most older girls, whether they have a laborious or frivolous life, whether they be confined to the paternal household or partially get away from it, the conquest of a husband, or at the least a serious lover, turns into a more and more pressing enterprise. This concern is often harmful for feminine friendships. The best friend loses her privileged place. The girl sees rivals more than partners in her companions. I knew one such girl, intelligent and talented, but who had chosen to think herself a faraway princess. This is how she described herself in poems and literary essays. She sincerely admitted she did not remain attached to her childhood friends. If they were ugly and stupid, she did not like them. If seductive, she feared them. The impatient wait for a man, often involving maneuvers, ruses, and humiliations, blocks the girl's horizon. She becomes egotistical and hard. And if Prince Charming takes his time appearing, disgust and bitterness set in. The girl's character and behavior express her situation. If it changes, the adolescent girl's attitude also changes. Today it is becoming possible for her to take her future in her hands, instead of putting it in those of the man. If she is absorbed by studies, sports, a professional training, or a social and political activity, she frees herself from the male obsession. She is less preoccupied by love and sexual conflicts. However, she has a harder time than the young man in accomplishing herself as an autonomous individual. I have said that neither her family nor customs assist her attempts. Besides, even if she chooses independence, she still makes a place in her life for the man, for love. She will often be afraid of missing her destiny as a woman if she gives herself over entirely to any undertaking. She does not admit this feeling to herself, but it is there. It distorts all her best efforts. It sets up limits. In any case, the woman who works wants to reconcile her success with purely feminine successes. That not only requires devoting considerable time to her appearance and beauty, but also, what is more serious, implies that her vital interests are divided. Outside of his regular studies, the male student amuses himself by freely exercising his mind, and from there emerge his best discoveries. The woman's daydreams are oriented in a different direction. She will think of her physical appearance, of man, of love. She will give the bare minimum to her studies, to her career. Whereas in these areas, nothing is as necessary as the superfluous. It is not a question of mental weakness, of a lack of concentration, but of a split in her interests that do not coincide well. A vicious circle is knotted here. People are often surprised to see how easily a woman gives up music, studies, or a job as soon as she has found a husband. This is because she had committed too little of herself to her projects to derive benefit from their accomplishment. Everything converges to hold back her personal ambition, while enormous social pressure encourages her to find a social position and justification in marriage. It is natural that she should not seek to create her place in this world by and for herself, or that she should seek it timidly. As long as perfect economic equality is not realized in society, and as long as customs allow the woman to profit as wife and mistress from the privileges held by certain men, the dream of passive success will be maintained in her and will hold back her own accomplishments. However the girl approaches her existence as an adult, her apprenticeship is not yet over. By small increments, or bluntly, she has to undergo her sexual initiation. There are girls who refuse. If sexually difficult incidents marked their childhood, if an awkward upbringing has gradually rooted a horror of sexuality in them, they carry over their adolescent repugnance of men. There are also circumstances that cause some women to have an extended virginity in spite of themselves. But in most cases, the girl accomplishes her sexual destiny at a more or less advanced age. How she braves it is obviously closely linked to her whole past. But this is also a novel experience that presents itself in unforeseen circumstances and to which she freely reacts. This is the new stage we must now consider. Chapter 3. Sexual Initiation. In a sense, woman's sexual initiation, like man's, begins in infancy. There is a theoretical and practical initiation period that follows continuously from the oral, anal, and genital phases up to adulthood. But the young girl's erotic experiences are not a simple extension of her previous sexual activities. They are very often unexpected and brutal. They always constitute a new occurrence that creates a rupture with the past. While she is going through them, all the problems the young girl faces are concentrated in an urgent and acute form. In some cases, the crisis is easily resolved. There are tragic situations where the crisis can only be resolved through suicide or madness. In any case, the way woman reacts to the experiences strongly affects her destiny. All psychiatrists agree on the extreme importance her erotic beginnings have for her. Their repercussions will be felt for the rest of her life. The situation is profoundly different here for man and woman from the biological, social, and psychological points of view. For man, the passage from childhood sexuality to maturity is relatively simple. Erotic pleasure is objectified. Now, instead of being realized in his imminent presence, this erotic pleasure is intended for a transcendent being. The erection is the expression of this need. With penis, hands, mouth, with his whole body, the man reaches out to his partner, but he remains at the heart of this activity, as the subject generally does before the objects he perceives and the instruments he manipulates. He projects himself toward the other without losing his autonomy. Feminine flesh is a prey for him, and he seizes in woman the attributes his sensuality requires of any object. Of course, he does not succeed in appropriating them. At least he holds them. The embrace and the kiss imply a partial failure, but this very failure is a stimulant and a joy. The act of love finds its unity in its natural culmination, orgasm. Coitus has a specific physiological aim. In ejaculation, the male releases burdensome secretions. After orgasm, the male feels complete relief, regularly accompanied by pleasure. And of course, pleasure is not the only aim. It is often followed by disappointment. The need has disappeared rather than having been satisfied. In any case, a definite act is consummated, and the man's body remains intact. The service he has rendered to the species becomes one with his own pleasure. Woman's eroticism is far more complex and reflects the complexity of her situation. It has been seen that instead of integrating forces of the species into her individual life, the female is prey to the species, whose interests diverge from her own ends. Note: refer to Volume 1, Chapter 1, in Part 1, Destiny, translation. This antinomy reaches its height in woman. One of its manifestations is the opposition of two organs, the clitoris and the vagina. At the infant stage, the former is the center of feminine eroticism. Some psychiatrists uphold the existence of vaginal sensitivity in little girls, but this is a very inaccurate opinion. At any rate, it would have only secondary importance. The clitoral system does not change with adulthood, and woman preserves this erotic autonomy her whole life. Note, unless excision is practiced, which is the rule in some primitive cultures. Like the male orgasm, the clitoral spasm is a kind of detumescence that occurs quasi-mechanically, but it is only indirectly linked to normal coitus. It plays no role whatsoever in procreation. The woman is penetrated and impregnated through the vagina. It becomes an erotic center uniquely through the intervention of the male, and this always constitutes a kind of rape. In the past, a woman was snatched from her childhood universe and thrown into her life as a wife by a real or simulated rape. This was an act of violence that changed the girl into a woman. It is also referred to as ravishing a girl's virginity or taking her flower. This deflowering is not the harmonious outcome of a continuous development. It is an abrupt rupture with the past, the beginning of a new cycle.